5.
Something is going on at the Small Business Administration. Accusations of whistleblower retaliation, turkey farming, hostile work environment, and widespread morale problems. The OSC investigated. SBA says they're trying to root out waste, fraud, and abuse. What's the real story? Join me, Jason Miller, next Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday morning at 7:05 for my special investigative series, Discouraged and Disrespected at SBA, exclusively on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Away from your radio? Listen to Federal News Radio directly on your desktop. Click the red Listen Now button near the top of the federalnewsradio.com homepage.
Welcome to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey. Glad to have you with us today, and I hope you're not suffering from a blizzard conditions where you are. Washington dodged a bullet on this one. We had some problems last week, but the anticipated ice storm passed us by, but Pennsylvania, New York, and New England are getting shellacked, and I know the Midwest is terrible shape, and should the Chicago Public Schools, as I understand it, have closed for the first time in 12 years. So things have got to be tough. My guests this morning are Federal Timesman Steve Watkins, who is editor, and senior writer Steve Losey. Gents, you with us? Yeah, you there? Okay, good deal. Yeah, I've got a lot to talk about. I'm looking over your this week's edition, but I wanted to first talk about the situation with the retiree annuity checks. I got a rash of emails, as I'm sure you did, excuse me, on Monday, and people said their annuity checks were light, $20 to $50 in some cases, and they were wondering if it was a mistake, what had happened. We checked here, took a look at it, and it appeared that Congress and it had delayed action in approving the extension of the Bush-era tax cuts, and that was the villain. But on further examination, closer examination, of course, there was a lot of foot-dragging, it turns out that it was something that expired. Are you guys up on that?
A little bit. It looks like from what OPM has posted on their site, it looks like they, as you said, because Congress dragged their feet and the political fight went on for so long that OPM didn't get the withholding tables in time to apply them to the January 3rd annuity payment. But they say that things have been straightened out now. They've got the right income tax withholding amounts. They've been applied them. They're going to affect the February 1st, 2011 payment and everything after that. And they said that in late January, well, I guess they should have gotten the notice of annuity adjustment, and so that should have straightened it out, I believe.
Okay, and it was one of those things that it was thing called making work pay credit that had expired, and the National Active and Retired Federal Employees, that would be NARF .org. Also has a bulletin up there explaining what it is. But apparently people are not going to get a refund, if you will, of the $20 or $40 or $50 that was taken out of their check. They'll have to readjust their rates, their tax withholding rates, if they want to. And that's done, I understand, through the IRS and not through OPM.
Yeah, I believe that's correct.
Okay, well, good, very good. Listen, a lot of stuff to talk about today. I'm looking at, I know you've been working on something dealing with the unions reacting to this anti-bureaucrat, anti-government mood that's really taken hold in Congress. We decided this is a story with legs. It's been around a little over a year now. What are the unions do to fighting back, and what can they do?
Well, they're trying to kind of mobilize the ranks. The American Federation of Government Employees has their conference here next week. Last week after the State of the Union, John Gage called a press a conference call with reporters and expressed his displeasure at just kind of the general way things have gone in the last couple of months. And he said that he's trying to gather his forces to try to fight these efforts to freeze federal staffing freeze federal pay, cut federal staffing levels, take a swipe at federal employees' retiree benefits. And one thing that AFGE is talking about doing is when they have all their thousands of members in D.C. next week, going to Capitol Hill, rounding people up, paying visits to all the appropriate lawmakers and people who are kind of taking a are taking a new interest in what federal employees make and who think that they're maybe getting a little bit too much, and trying to show, hey, these are people who make this country work, make the government work. And so that's one thing. They're hoping to try to just appeal to people's lawmakers' sense of I don't know. So and they're also trying to round up their members to talk to people in their local communities, their neighbors, and say, hey, I work for the Veterans Affairs Department. I help, you know, veterans who have been wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm not a leech. I'm not someone who's, you know, pulling a scam on the country by getting a decent paycheck. I'm someone who actually contributes. And they're thinking it's a grassroots kind of thing that's required. They're planning some radio ads and other forms of outreach. So basically, it's a the unions are planning an outreach effort on several levels.
Yeah, basically trying to put a human face on the federal employees and try to engender some empathy from the American public. And that's really the bigger obstacle here. Is in general, federal employees are not at all popular with the American public, and as a result, that means they're not so popular in Congress anymore.
Well, it seems like it's always been the case that if you do a public opinion poll and you say, what are the least appreciated occupations in the country, and of course, as we all know, reporters are usually way down there with used car salesmen and others, but people will say they have a low opinion of Congress and politicians, and yet they often will cite their member of Congress or their two senators as the exception to the rule. And it's as if the rest of them are a bunch of crooks and losers, but my particular one is great.
Right.
You know, and is that what they're going after when you talk about personalizing this?
Well, the same effect applies to federal employees. You know, most surveys show that, yes, American citizens overall have a poor view of federal employees, but for the ones that they generally have close interaction with, Social Security folks, perhaps Border Protection.
Your letter carrier, too. Huh?
Letter carriers, yeah. The Postal Service has very high marks. Less so probably with the airport screeners.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, particularly those who work with benefits, VA generally has pretty high marks with the patients at VA hospitals. You know, those folks are held in very high regard by the American public.
Well, I wonder, maybe you guys can comment on this. The federal unions in the last election, I think exclusively, supported President Obama's campaign, AFGE and TEU, the major postal unions. And in the past, they supported the Democratic candidate. Do you think the unions are starting to feel that maybe the Democratic Party is taking them for granted, that they can do anything they want?
Perhaps. Last week, John Gage, you know, expressed his disappointment at some of Obama's statements and his skepticism about Obama's desire to reorganize the government. The flip side of that coin is, where else are they going to go? The Republicans, if the Democrats, I'm going to generalize here, if the Democrats have taken unions for granted, the Republicans have been somewhat hostile. So I think they realize, you know, they got to dance with the one that brung them, so to speak. So they got to stick with the Democrats, and they got to try to kind of push them to say, "Hey, don't throw us under the bus as all this deficit reduction stuff comes around. Stand up and fight for us, because we fought for you guys," and they kind of expect payback now.
Well, you know, they're calling for a new era of civility in Congress. Republicans sit with Democrats during the State of the Union, and a less, you know, rancorous talk and more cooperation. And a good model of that in the previous Congress was the House committee that handles civil service matters for federal workers. You had Henry Waxman, the chairman, and then Tom Davis, the ranking minority member, and they got along famously. They fought, but it was always very good-natured, and they'd sort of change issues and then go on about it. And you're wondering if that can be restored. Let us take a break here, though, and we'll come back and talk more about getting along in Washington and how, what benefit it might be to federal workers. Be right back here on WFED 1500 AM.
Rain and snow might be brushed off by a material that mimics spider hair. It also offers the promise of self-cleaning products. Spiders apparently stay dry because of their messy and uneven hair. So Wolfgang Sigmund, a University of Florida engineer, mimicked their disheveled do on the surface of a plastic film.
The structures almost look like they're damaged or bad because the hairs are crooked, some are completely bent, the distance varies in between the hairs.
Microscopic images show that chaotic physical structure keeps water droplets in a perfect sphere and the new material dry and clean.
Basically, with the water that's rolling off, the dirt is being transported away.
And Sigmund says repelling water with physics rather than chemistry may pose fewer health risks. To find out more about this and other engineering innovation stories, please go to www.nae.edu/radio. That's nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Things just don't happen. You need a plan. A federal career can last 30 years or more, and so can federal retirement. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to get the information you need to plan your course for financial security, solid benefits, and optimum health care. 100% focused on the federal employee for your benefit. Presented by NITP has the answers to your mid-career and retirement planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit Mondays at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Federal News Radio for an hour that can change your future.
What is the One DHS vision and strategy? How is DHS right-sizing and consolidating its physical footprint? And what is DHS doing to better manage its resources and execute its overall mission? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these and other questions with Rafael Boris, Undersecretary for Management at DHS, next week on the Business of Government Hour.
The FedCloud blog on federalnewsradio.com takes a look at the issues surrounding cloud computing through the eyes of those who are using it every day. We'll share with you the challenges, opportunities, and lessons learned from some of the top minds in the world of federal IT. Collaborate with others and help shape the discussion on cloud computing at the FedCloud blog on federalnewsradio.com or follow the FedCloud blog on Twitter. The FedCloud blog is sponsored by Cisco and Intel.
It's always nighttime somewhere, so who do military organizations around the globe turn to when they require the most widely accepted night vision technology in the world? ITT Defense and Information Solutions, now delivering enhanced night vision goggles with helmet-mounted fused technologies to deliver the latest in night vision capabilities for the dismounted warfighter. ITT Defense and Information Solutions, doing essential things in extraordinary ways. Visit them at defense.itt.com.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, and AVU Technologies. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Join AGA for its National Leadership Conference, February 17th and 18th at the Ronald Reagan Building and International Trade Center. AGA will bring together government, financial, management, and accountability leaders to share valuable insight, proven strategies, lessons learned, sessions over current issues relating to the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the effects of political transitions, and what the future holds. Show your commitment to a more accountable future. Register today at agacgfm.org/NLC.
Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with Steve Losey, a senior correspondent for the Federal Times, and Steve Watkins, the editor of the Federal Times. And we're talking about the political situation, the fact that John Gage of the AFGE and Colleen Hiller of the National Treasury Employees Union are obviously unhappy with the Obama administration, but they almost seem to have nowhere to go because they are They have endorsed these, and the Republicans have not been very kind to them. You know, there was a time, going back to the Nixon era, when the president of the AFGE, John Greiner, as an individual, endorsed President Nixon for re-election, and the presidents of the National Association of Government Employees and the National Association of Letter Carriers also endorsed President Nixon as individuals, not as union leaders, but that was very symbolic, and they got a lot out of the Nixon administration. Do you ever see a time when the government, the federal unions as they're constituted, would back a Republican?
Today, no, I don't see that. I think it's kind of an interesting trend going on these days where, you know, as you say, you know, the issue of pay parity, which of course all feds are aware of, and that has to do with civilian employees getting the same raise as military personnel, that has enjoyed bipartisan support for many years. But on the Republican side, largely that support has come from the moderate side of the Republican Party, the folks like Tom Davis and George Voinovich and those folks. And a lot of them have left in the last election, and we may see more of that, and we see a little bit more perhaps polarization on the Republican side. So it'll be interesting to see where things go. We've got now a chairman of the Personnel Subcommittee on the House side who is a Tea Party backed Republican who is very unvarnished in his call to roll back federal pay and benefits. And so I think we may actually see things going in the other direction, if anything, is what I would predict.
Interesting. Back in the day, the federal unions, and whether it was cynical or smart, they used to keep what they called a House Republican. And they had somebody that working for them was a fellow named Tom Walters, who was with the American Federation of Government Employees for a while. And he had very good links with the Republican side, particularly of the Senate. And he would go up there and get things done. And at one point, the AFGE hired a retired member of the Senate from Kansas, a Republican, to be on one of their lobbyists. And it seemed to be an era of more goodwill than it is now. But you don't see that happening again.
Well, it could certainly happen in the future. You know, the political pendulum is constantly swinging back and forth, and it may do that again. But I think as long as the economy is where it's at, unemployment is where it's at, I think for the most part that is driving the whole bus here. Once the economy starts improving in a real way, unemployment gets off the table is a real problem for normal Americans, then we may see a things shift back a little bit more towards the center on these issues.
With the weather here in the Washington area last year, we had a 31-inch snowstorm, which is unusual for just about any place, but particularly here. And the government was shut down for 5 days, and many people said that lesson, that along with the continuity of government, would jumpstart teleworking. And Congress has taken some steps to encourage more people to do it. But that said, and last week we had a day off for government workers, and yesterday John Berry, the director of the OPM, announced that, anticipating problems in the Washington area today, that people could telework if they wanted to and take unexcused leave or if they needed to. But is teleworking working?
Great question. It's increasing, but in my mind, I think that's the million-dollar question here is, yes, more people are teleworking as a percentage of the eligible telework workforce, but the question is, what is actually being done? Is it working? How effective is that work that's being done from home or from telework centers? And I think one real barrier, you know, a lot of discussion is put on what are the barriers to telework, management resistance, work office coverage, that kind of thing. But I think possibly the biggest barrier is really just getting a handle on some real performance metrics. Is telework actually delivering good work and quality work? And I think until we can see some figures on that, I can't imagine managers getting really too warm and fuzzy about telework.
Well, yeah, that's an excellent point, measuring it, because everything you hear about teleworking, virtually everything you hear about it, is good. Cuts down on absenteeism. It eliminates tardiness. People are tend to work longer. They're more relaxed. They're in better shape. They will work. They'll put in a 10-hour day, whereas they might not otherwise. And everything sounds good, but there got to be some downsides to it. And I wonder also if this isn't a generational thing, because many years ago, I worked for a man. I was sort of a personal assistant to this guy. He was a millionaire, and he lived in Arlington. I lived in the district. And I would take a bus to his house every day, just about every day, wearing a suit, and he would answer the door wearing a suit. And we went in, and he had a tiny little office. He had two typewriters. This was pre-computers, obviously. He had two typewriters, two phones, and we would work there. I'd take off my suit jacket and hang it up. But he'd created an office environment at home. At noon, we would break. The maid would make us soup and something, and we'd walk around his garden for half an hour, quarter hour, and then come back and work. And then at 4 o'clock, he'd let me go home early, and I'd put on my coat and go home. But he created an office environment, and it seemed to work beautifully. But I think for a lot of people who are not used to that, and a lot of older people, if you're out of sight, you're probably sitting around in your pajamas and maybe doing other things or watching Oprah. Is this a generational problem, you think?
I think that is a factor. And, you know, one thing, last year when we had the Snowmageddon storm, I tried to talk to a lot of people who at least took a stab at teleworking last year. And some people, you know, the reaction I got was very, very mixed. Some people said, you know, yes, I worked hard. I did as much as I could. And some people, you know, answered a few emails. You know, did a little bit of work here and there, and then played in the snow. So, I mean, it's very mixed. It really depends on person to person how much a person can accomplish from home, how motivated they are, and whether the requirements have been specifically spelled out in advance. And that's one thing that I think this new telework bill that was passed last fall seeks to correct. The telework bill that was passed in November requires managers and employees to sign written telework agreements that spells out what's expected of each of them. You know, what's expected of the employee who's teleworking and what's expected of the manager who has to oversee that person when he's not physically in the same location. And, you know, when I was writing the story about this, I talked to Pat Niehaus from the Federal Managers Association, and she said that's going to be the most vital part of implementing this telework bill is how good those written agreements are. You know, she thinks they should say when an employee will telework, what hours that person will work, what kind of work he'll do, how he'll turn it in, so on and so forth. So if agencies can really get those written agreements in place and effective, we may see some real progress in increasing the amount of telework. If not, the whole thing just may continue to sputter.
What you guys said about the metrics and needing a way to actually measure this struck home with me. When I was at the Washington Post for about the last 5 or 6 years, I teleworked usually on a Friday, and I would go to the Post. The Post had still does have a bureau in Rockville. They had one in Alexandria and Leesburg and whatnot. And I would go to the different bureaus because I had friends out there. And it was a wonderful day for me because the phones were lighter. I didn't get as many calls. I had a chance to catch up on emails and write the column and whatnot. But what I was thinking at the time was I was still in an office environment. I was still surrounded by colleagues, albeit I was kind of the stranger in the place. But also, I had a product to produce. I had to do the column, and I had to do certain electronic newsletters that were sent out. So if anybody was measuring me, they could tell instantly what I was doing. Whereas if your duties or maybe decision-making or you're in some kind of planning or long-range strategic thing, it's going to be very hard to quantify that and qualify it.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, and that's where these agreements are going to have to come in, and managers are really going to have to think hard about what is the end product, what are the performance goals, the production goals for people who are teleworking, and you know, to be honest, that's really the bigger issue here. You know, we've pay for performance, obviously, is a hugely controversial issue, and one of the biggest problems with the way a lot of the pay for performance systems have been rolled out, at least early on, and I think it continues today, is that managers have always struggled with that very task, which is defining what makes for good performance for their employees. And you have to do the same thing here with telework. And a good example, OPM's latest report on telework says 78 agencies had employees who were teleworking at least once a month, but only 27 agencies reported some sort of cost savings benefit, and the greatest benefit that they could point to was morale. Now, in declining order, it also includes productivity. And most federal employees who have teleworked say that they are more productive working from home without all the interruptions that they have at the office than they are when they're in the office. So there's reason to think that productivity goes up, but until, you know, there are some numbers put to that, I think managers are going to remain skeptical.
Good point. Taking a short break here, I'm talking with Steve Watkins and Steve Losey of the Federal Times. We'll be right back here on WFED 1500 AM.
Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has waived its earlier limitation on selling gasoline that contains more than 10% ethanol from model year 2001 through 2006 passenger vehicles, including cars, SUVs, and light pickup trucks. The waiver applies to fuel that contains up to 15% ethanol, known as E15. EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson says recently completed testing by the Department of Energy shows E15 does not harm emissions control equipment in the vehicles. The National Farmers Union says the decision means E15 will soon be available for approximately 60% of all vehicles in the U.S. The Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007 mandated an increase in the overall amount of renewable fuels, such as ethanol, into the marketplace.
General Dynamics Information Technology, delivering the strength of technology to achieve mission success. General Dynamics IT. Visit GDIT.com to learn more.
I wasn't born to go with the flow. I was born to make a difference, to make waves. I want my sweat and hard work to mean something. I was born to serve in the United States Coast Guard. If you were born ready to lead, to protect, to uphold the law, then visit GoCoastGuard.com. The United States Coast Guard. Born ready.
Sponsored by the United States Coast Guard. In cooperation with the Maryland, D.C., Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station.
I wasn't born to go with the flow. I was born to make a difference, to make waves. I want my sweat and hard work to mean something. I was born to serve in the United States Coast Guard. If you were born ready to lead, to protect, to uphold the law, then visit GoCoastGuard.com. The United States Coast Guard. Born ready.
Sponsored by the United States Coast Guard. In cooperation with the Maryland, D.C., Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station.
Jack be nimble, Jack be quick. Jack knocked over a candlestick onto the shag carpeting, and his pants ignited into flames, causing him to stop, drop, and roll. Luckily, Jack recently had Geico help him with renter's insurance, because all his belongings went up in flames. Jack got full replacement and now has new pants he ordered from Banana Republic. Visit Geico.com and see how affordable renter's insurance can be.
Hey, Caps fans, make sure you check out the Caps Academy and youth hockey websites at WashingtonCaps.com. These are awesome sites where players, parents, coaches, and fans of all ages can find everything there is to know about hockey, including the basic rules of the game, advanced coaching strategies, and information on youth hockey programs in the D.C. area. You'll also find plenty of instructional videos and tips featuring Caps coaches and players. For all this and more, check out the Caps Academy and youth hockey websites at WashingtonCaps.com.
Since 1886, the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington, D.C. has been helping children in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Now they are visited by over 3,000 children every day. The club teaches character and leadership development and arts education. No child is turned away for being unable to pay the $25 fee, and the club needs your help to make this happen. Give a gift online at bgcgw.org. The life you lift up today will be the life that brings a better world tomorrow. This message is brought to you by GEICO and Federal News Radio.
Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey. I'm talking with Federal Timesman Steve Watkins, who is the editor, and Steve Losey, who is a senior reporter for the Federal Times. And got a notice here from OPM, and glad to mention this. The federal retirees who are getting payments from OPM can change their tax withholding amounts from both federal and state taxes by going through OPM, and they would call 1-888-767-6738, or they can make changes online at www.opm.gov/retire. So that's a way to get that done if you want to bring your check back up to the 2010 levels. Folks, we're talking about the pros and cons of teleworking and making it work. And I remember many, many years ago, the government decided it was going to go to a 6-day week operation. They were going to be open on Saturdays. And the idea was they could have people working 4-day weeks, but somebody would take a Saturday shift, and it had as much steam behind it at the time as teleworking, and it sort of fizzled for a variety of reasons, and one of them was the backers of this thing claimed that the public didn't respond. Social Security was open on Saturdays in many locations. The IRS was open in many locations, and they said it. Their feeling was that the public didn't want to deal with the government on their day off. They wanted to take a day off and deal with the government. So the Saturday thing wasn't of much use to them. But primarily, the problem was that they couldn't show any real benefit to the taxpayers. Many federal workers liked the idea of going to a 4-day week and having this 6-day work week, but it didn't do anything for the taxpayers. And you're saying this has got to teleworking, in order to really catch hold, has got to show that it has some tangible benefit other than just good morale for the federal workers.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, and. You know, really, the managers here are going to make or break telework. That's the simple fact. They are going to decide who can telework for how many days a week or month, and it's really in their lap. And it's up to them to make it work by essentially having a good business case. I don't think it's enough just to roll out a telework plan just because it boosts morale. There are agencies out there that have real morale issues. Homeland Security comes to mind, and TSA and some others. Obviously, if you're a screener, there's no way you can telework. There's just, you know, there's a lot of jobs out there where you just can't do it. But for those where it is possible, where telework is an eligible option, you know, managers are just going to have to think through it pretty hard. But I think in their own minds and in terms of convincing their own supervisors that this is a good idea, they're going to need a good, solid business plan.
There's a political element, too. When the telework bill was being debated last fall, there were some Republicans, including Congressman Phil Gingrey of Georgia, who opposed it because they saw it as yet another benefit for federal employees while the rest of the country was, you know, struggling to, you know, pay the bills. Congressman Gingrey said it will cost another $30 million while promoting an even more inefficient federal workforce. There is this perception out there that telework is just an excuse for feds to slack. And if it's going to survive, the government is going to have to show tangible benefits, because if they don't, we may see lawmakers, you know, pick away at it and oppose it, or it, at the very least, oppose any efforts to facilitate telework in the future.
Well, I think that's true now more than ever, that there may have been a time when Congress would approve something based on the fact that it made government workers happier and presumably more productive. But now I think you're going to have to show that there is a direct benefit to the taxpayers or the customer base rather than just giving feds another perk. You mentioned Homeland Security, and I know before we're talking about what to talk about on this show, you said Homeland Security is rolling out a number of new programs that are going to encourage insourcing and beef up the skills of its managers. What's that all about?
Well, I talked to Jeff Neal, who is the Chief Human Capital Officer at DHS the other week, and he said that as far as the insourcing effort, they're trying to take a look at what's called the balanced workforce, the proportion of employees who are actual federal employees and the proportion of contractors. Now, when DHS was created almost 8 years ago, it was, as you recall, a shotgun marriage. Things, agencies were thrown together very quickly, and DHS was frequently underfunded, undermanned, so they had to rely a lot more on contractors than, you know, other agencies might have. Now Jeff Neal is trying to, now that things have sort of settled down, Jeff Neal is trying to take a step back and look at where we are, who do we have contracting, how many, and do we need all these people? So about 9 months ago, they created a new program office headed by one of his senior executives that's taking a look. The pilot test is taking a look at about 100 contracts of varying sizes and studying should these people are contract. This is contracted out right now. Should it stay contracted out? Should it be brought into the government? Should there be a mix? Or do we even need to be doing this at all? Has the agency moved beyond the point where we even need to do this? So they're wrapping up the review of this first 100 any day now, and eventually they're going to start taking a look at all roughly 10,000 service contracts in the department. This is going to take years. This is going to be something that's going to go on for several years because there's a lot of things that need to be looked at, and they don't want to like just jump in the middle of a contract period. They're kind of timing it towards the end of each contract. So, you know, if they decide, well, we need to bring this in-house, they'll just let the contract expire or renegotiate or things like that.
Well, you know, that's food for thought because a year or so ago, the Obama administration said they wanted to go out and identify jobs that had been contracted out by the Bush administration and particularly a lot of them by the Clinton administration, but identify those that were inherently governmental and bring them back into government where they had more control over them. Now you're talking about, the same people are talking about a 15% cut, and I was wondering when worlds collide how this would work. But you bring up another possibility, and that was also mentioned in the president's State of the Union thing, is the duplication of effort by different federal agencies.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, and there's going to be a lot of focus on that, I think, going forward. And we've got a government accountability office investigation underway right now. We should see some results possibly within the next month, where they are looking at all the areas of duplication within the government. Clearly, the direction of that is to fuel some options for how to best consolidate government programs.
Well, you know, that could create, without hyping it, that could create some major turf wars, I would think, within the federal government. About 10 years ago, there was a move sponsored primarily by the FBI to consolidate the FBI and the Drug Enforcement Administration. The FBI wanted to take over DEA, and there was a big fight and looked for a time as if it would succeed. And the DEA people argued that they really only enforce one law, and that is the drug thing, whereas the FBI enforces several hundred federal laws, and that they said their specialization was necessary and there was a good reason for it. And I remember having a discussion with the editorial board of a newspaper, and they were all for merging the FBI with the DIA, or more correctly, merging the DEA into the FBI. And I just, as a devil's advocate, I said, well, by the same token, we should merge the Maryland and Virginia and D.C. desks of our newspaper, and we should merge advertising and editorial. And they said, no, that's absurd. You can't do that. We need the specialization. But I can foresee major turf wars in the government when they go after duplication and they say, okay, the Agriculture Department is no longer going to be in charge of the Forest Service. We'll put that into Interior.
You're exactly right. I anticipate a lot of fun cover stories over the next year or two just based on that. And it's not only going to be a lot of turf battles within the government, but also within Congress. You can't shift around responsibilities and roles of different agencies without getting into some rice bowls on the Hill, and you're going to have just as many problems there. And we've seen that with Homeland Security. When Homeland Security was formed, suddenly you had pretty much every conceivable, every committee and subcommittee on the Hill had some sort of finger in the pie of Homeland Security, just because it was such a conglomeration from all across the government.
That's absolutely, that is so true. We'll take a break here and we'll come back and talk some more about the possible coming turf wars here on WFED 1500 AM.
The Pentagon and Beyond, brought to you by Airink.
The Arab world is consumed by protests demanding democracy and justice. Yemen's president is hoping to shut down unrest by offering concessions. But will it be enough? The changes sweeping the region may mean upheaval is not far away. Sporadic demonstrations have already struck that poor Arabian Peninsula state, and the protests are taking place with the understanding that Al-Qaeda sympathizer Anwar el-Awlaki has inspired attacks there to deal with their discontent. I'm J.J. Green.
There's a lot of talk about thinking outside the box. But what about thinking inside the box? Airink is a company that looks at every angle when solving problems. In fact, Airink recently helped convert regular cargo containers into sophisticated air traffic and communications control facilities for use abroad, combining the shipping box and actual equipment into one turnkey system. Imagine that. Log on to www.arinc.com to learn more.
Government personnel must continue to achieve mission-critical objectives no matter their work environment. Video conferencing technologies provide a highly effective collaboration solution for federal employees affected by budget cuts, BRAC initiatives, and telework mandates if they are secure based on open standards and deployable in limited bandwidth environments. Polycom is the first video provider to have an ultimate HD portfolio that is JITC certified, offering real-time face-to-face communication without compromising secure networks or consuming excessive bandwidth. Polycom enables government customers to collaborate over voice and video anywhere, anytime, securely both inside and outside the firewall, offering high-definition video calls at half the bandwidth of other companies. To learn more, visit polycom.com/federal.
The Telework Center arms you with all the information you need to know about teleworking in the federal government. Go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Polycom.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday at 10 a.m. here on WFED 1500 AM. This week, my special guest is Rick Leeson, CFA and founder of Frontier Advisors, LLC. The show is sponsored by Odin Feldman & Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia. For more information, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
I wasn't born to go with the flow. I was born to make a difference, to make waves. I want my sweat and hard work to mean something. I was born to serve in the United States Coast Guard. If you were born ready to lead, to protect, to uphold the law, then visit GoCoastGuard.com. The United States Coast Guard. Born ready.
Sponsored by the United States Coast Guard. In cooperation with the Maryland, D.C., Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station.
Mortgages should be illegal because you're getting robbed every month. For example, if you have a typical $200,000 30-year mortgage, you're going to end up paying over $400,000 after interest. That's almost a quarter of $1 million that you could be putting into your pocket instead of the bank's. I want to send you a powerful free CD to show you how. Hi, I'm John Commuta, creator of the Transforming Debt into Wealth system. My proven system can eliminate your mortgage and all your other debts using just the money you already make. That's right, no credit card debt, no car payment, no mortgage. It's easy, it works.
I will be able to pay off my house in approximately 2.5 years on a 30-year mortgage.
Stop getting robbed of your money and your future. Call now and I'll rush you a free CD today. Call 1-800-500-2884. For your free CD, call 1-800-500-2884. 1-800-500-2884.
The Dorebeck Insider, hosted by award-winning journalist and free thinker Chris Dorebeck. Engage your mind every afternoon from 3 to 7 as Chris engages the best minds in federal procurement, management, IT, and human resources. The Dorebeck Insider takes on subjects critical for an efficient government. Chris's guests answer the questions you want answered. Tune in to hear how the news shapes your daily interactions in the federal space. The Dorebeck Insider, weekday afternoons from 3 to 7, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
My Mike Causey. Welcome back to Your Turn. We're talking with Federal Times editor Steve Watkins and senior writer Steve Losey about a variety of things. And you bring up a really good point. When the talk of the administration, and I think they're sincere in this, wants to eliminate duplication in government, but it's hard for most of us to realize the behind-the-scenes political machinations that go on. You mentioned that the Department of Homeland Security is now overseen by a couple of hundred congressional committees and subcommittees. Everybody wants a piece of the action. And I recall some years back, a friend of mine was an executive officer aboard an aircraft carrier. And we were talking one time, I was on the carrier, and we were talking one time, and he showed me the area where they kept the cash. And I said, cash? You know, it's a floating city, 4,500 people, I think was the compliment. And he's. Well, wasn't that bad a story, was it? Okay. Create a national emergency. I apologize for that, folks. Anyhow, my friend was on the aircraft carrier, and he said that they would get calls from members of Congress to take the aircraft carrier, take it out on a cruise, a shakedown or what have you, and take it to a different city and dock and leave it there for a couple of days just so these 4,500 sailors could leave the carrier and go spend money. And it was even those things were politically motivated, their end result. And I can see this when they start saying, okay, we want to eliminate duplication. And Congressman X will say, yes, but don't eliminate the agency in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, because that's my district, and we get rid of the one that's duplicating it in Lebanon, Indiana.
Yeah, it's Congress obviously holds the strings on all of it. Will allow some of it to happen, and certainly not all of it. There's a story, and I don't know the nitty gritty details, but I don't know if it's DC legend, but our reporter Sean Riley's been looking into this duplication issue and said that when NOAA was created, I think this was back in the 70s, the logical place for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration was the Interior Department, but there was some lawmaker who was part of that deal who just apparently had some personal beef with whoever was the head of Interior at that time, and said, nope, it's going into Commerce.
Or was it Nixon?
It may have been under Nixon. I don't know.
You know, that's very interesting, because when you think about it, yeah, the NOAA, Commerce Department, I mean, right. What are we doing? But yeah, well, and I think people who aren't in the know, and that includes us most of the time, don't realize sometimes how petty these particular things can be. I heard of one of a Republican lawmaker, and I don't want to libel somebody because it was, I don't know what it was, North Dakota or South Dakota, but he was lobbying against having more nuclear missiles silos put in his state, which would have been a boon to the economy in those two states. But he was lobbying against it, and they were trying to find out why he voted against it. And the story went that he had not been invited to President Reagan's birthday party, and so a major economic issue was decided, you know, based on that sort of pettiness.
Well, another thing that happens fairly frequently is, you know, look what happens every time the Post Service decides, you know, hey, yeah, we need to close a post office, and that lawmaker says, oh, no, you know, you can't do that, because even if, you know, nobody goes to this post office, that it's still a loss of prestige for that lawmaker. Or, you know, whenever the military tries to close a base, there's always that big hue and cry from the lawmakers and whose communities would be affected by it.
Well, that's true. Having your own zip code can be a very big deal. Beverly Hills 2090 or whatever, and the same with any facility like that. And I've seen numbers from defense that every defense job, civilian job that comes into an area, and by the same token that would leave, takes six other jobs with it. You know, from real estate people to restaurateurs and whatnot. So this is a very complicated business we're in. Do we have time to talk about? I know you're looking at what the State Department is doing, introducing some new personnel initiatives.
That's right. You know, I talked to Nancy Powell, who is the chief human capital officer at State last week, or a little more than a week ago, and she said that one of the things that she's concerned with is the issue of language training for foreign service officers, diplomats and such. For a long time, foreign language training was viewed by some in State Department as just kind of a nice thing to have. You know, during the Cold War, the 90s, we had diplomats in Russia, and all these diplomats, you know, spoke English, and it wasn't quite so crucial that you needed to learn how to speak Russian or Chinese or German or whatever, because you could get by. Now we're in, obviously, the post 9/11 age. You've got people in Karachi, Pakistan. You've got people in going out into very rough parts of Afghanistan, and they need to deal with tribal chieftains, and so they need to learn Pashto or Urdu, or also Arabic, especially Farsi. And there's a perception in the State Department that if you spend a year learning those, intensively learning those foreign languages, that's a wasted year because you don't get promoted during that time. And Director General Powell wants to fix that. So she's about to start negotiating with the American Foreign Service Association on getting foreign language rolled into the promotion precepts, the list of factors that promotion boards consider when they take a look at whether a foreign service officer should be promoted. So the AFSA is, I spoke to AFSA's president yesterday, they're on board with this, and they say, hey, that's a good thing. More language training is always good because it can get kind of dangerous for a foreign service officer to go into an area like Pakistan or Afghanistan and not be 100% up on the language.
That's right. If your translator gets it wrong or has had a bad day and doesn't like you, you could be in a heap of trouble.
Yeah, I mean, how do you know they're not saying, you know, hey, there's a bomb over there, or, you know, hey, there's an American, let's kidnap them.
That's fascinating. So when they're in language training, they are not eligible or they don't get promotions.
It's not that they're not eligible. It's just when you spend a year learning in a classroom learning a foreign language and you go up against someone who's been in the thick of it in Afghanistan.
I see,
or, you know, that person is just going to look so much better, and you can't use that foreign language as an argument for promotion. Now, they say when you do get promoted, after you do finish your foreign language training, it pays off in the long term. You go over to Pakistan or wherever, and they say they've done studies that show that people who go through foreign language training get promoted very quickly after they finish. But getting people to understand that and accept that, that's what they're trying to fix.
Yeah, because most people want it now rather than wait a year or two. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. One thing I noticed in the front-page story you have about it's a TSA halts expansion of privatized airport screeners. How's that going very quickly?
Well, the TSA has about 16 airports that have that in the last decade or so have opted out of federal screening. They got private contractors to do the screening for them, and there's, I believe, about five or so who had asked for additional airports who'd asked for permission to opt out of TSA. And just last Friday, John Pistol, the TSA administrator, said, "No, we're going to cap it at 16." They say they're not going to, you know, renege on the 16 agreements, the 16 agencies, airports that have already opted out, but no more. So some lawmakers like Congressman Micah from Florida, who have been critics of TSA, especially with the whole controversy over the pat-down, the very revealing screenings, and are supporters of contracting out TSA's screening duties, they're not happy at all. And Congressman Micah said he's going to look into this, hold investigations, and so we'll just have to stay tuned and see what the long-term fallout from this decision is.
What would be the advantage to an airport having private screeners? I mean, do they pay for the federal presence? Do they pay for part of that, or are they they shaving money with private contractors?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure whether they get how the money is handled. I think in TSA has gotten its share of criticism for being, in some people's view, too intrusive, too heavy-handed, and some these airports felt that they can do it better and less, you know, offensively to.